this over the last several years, jointly with the Kaiser Family Foundation, and particularly Jennifer Cates, who will be one of our speakers here today. We've used it as an occasion to revisit regularly the outcomes on global public health in the G8, but we've also used it typically, and we'll be doing this today, to speak to many of the bigger other issues that are treated at the G8 so that we can take a sort of full accounting. I want to mention just as a note that last night the House took action on the PEPFAR reauthorization, which was a major step forward, and which included lifting the travel ban on persons living with HIV. This was going to be moving towards the President's signature. It's a major historic development, and the Congress should be congratulated, particularly Senators John Kerry and Representative Barbara Lee, for leading on that. Our approach here this morning, we have several terrific speakers. I'm going to turn in a moment to my colleague Michael Green, who's senior advisor and holds the Japan chair at CSIS and is an associate professor of international relations at Georgetown, has a long and distinguished career in Japan and working on Japan and Korea and other related issues at the National Security Council, at the Department of Defense. I'm going to ask Michael to introduce the ambassador who will, Ambassador Fushizaki, who will lead us off with some opening remarks around how he saw the overall outcomes from the summit. I will then turn to Professor Takimi, who led the Japanese working group that did all of the preparatory work on global health issues for the G8 summit on behalf of the Japanese government. Professor Takimi brought his working group to Washington as part of his global consultations about 6 or 8 weeks prior to the G8 summit. We had the opportunity to join with him and participate with him, and he kindly agreed to come and be with us today to provide considerable more detail on this. I'll also then, after those two speakers, turn to Assistant Secretary Dan Sullivan, who's with us today. He heads the Economic and Business Affairs Bureau at State Department and was involved in the team at the White House in putting that program together. And then we'll turn to Jen Cates, who will discuss some data on ODA commitments by major donors, trend lines 2001 to 2006. This is an annual report that that she and Eric Leaf have been producing over the last several years, which has become a major point of reference. So I want to thank you all for coming. After we run through those presentations, we'll have lots of opportunity for interaction, questions and comments from you. And I do know that the ambassador is under some time pressure, and when we do get to that period of question and answer, we'll be giving special preference to any questions that would be directed to him. So thank you very much. Mike, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Steve. I have the privilege of introducing Ambassador Ichiro Fushizaki, my friend of many years. Steve also asked me to, if I'm right, to give a few minutes of a scene setter, since this is an audience of diverse expertise and some experts on Japan, some on health, some on the G8, some like Takumi Sensei on all of the above. So I thought I'd give a few opening scene setter comments on the G8, what it means and what this one meant. There were doubts, and there have been doubts, about the purpose of the G8 and about what could actually be accomplished in this meeting for a number of reasons. The pundits have noted and argued that the G8 is losing relevance, that the international architecture of these summit meetings and of international institutions doesn't reflect the real distribution of power anymore, with the rise of Asia, in particular China and India. Of course, neither is formally in the G8 process. In addition, a number of people have argued that the G8 has made lofty statements in the past, but no one follows up on the commitments. It's just a talk shop. Others have pointed out that particularly in this G8, you have a series of political leaders coming to the Toyoko summit who were in various states of distress in their own domestic political context. The only two leaders of the G8 this time who had high poll ratings were Medvedev of Russia, who had about 62% in recent polls, although some polls show him with 42%. Putin still enjoys over 90%, but he wasn't there. The Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, who had pretty high polling in the 60s. But most of the rest of the leaders had declining polls below 40%. Sarkozy fell down to 37%, a 10-point drop in the month before. President Bush has hovered around 30%. Prime Minister Fukuda was dropping down to 25-26%. And so a number of people questioned whether this could be an effective G8 given these political weaknesses at home, and especially people targeted President Bush and said he's a lame duck, he's done, won't get anything done in this meeting. There were clear divisions on climate change going into this. Prime Minister Fukuda put forward the idea of the so-called 50-50, 50% reductions by 2050. People expected the U.S. would fight this tooth and nail. There were also divisions about whether the main focus of climate change would be the G8 or their major economies meeting, the proposal President Bush made at the UN a year ago for the major economies to meet and talk about climate change. So who would dominate this? Would it be Japan or the U.S.? Would there be a major confrontation? How would India and China play? Surely they would try to sabotage this because they don't want to be pulled into climate change commitments. And then there was a general sense that, that the neoliberal order, which the G8 always champions, free trade, open markets, and so forth, would come under assault because of the subprime crisis, because of food and oil prices and so forth. Well, in fact, it turned out pretty well. The U.S. and Japan agreed pretty easily on the 50-50 goals. China and India came into the process. Those are two firsts. The U.S. agreed to climate change numbers for the first time, and China and India were part of a global discussion of working on climate change at the summit level. The leaders reaffirmed their commitments. The U.S. in particular pushed with Japan for accountability, not just new pledges. In particular, which I think my colleagues will talk about, increases in commitments on funding for Africa for global health and so forth. There were very strong signals that the leaders were going to resist pressures for protectionism or more intrusive government policies on issues related to the subprime or sovereign wealth funds. They put out a pretty strong statement on Zimbabwe, and there were no major kerfuffles. There were no major problems. The only one really was Medvedev's criticism of missile defense, which got some press. So it came out pretty well. As Mark Twain might have said, the rumors of the G8's demise are premature. And there are a few other things that Dan may not be able to say. Dan and I worked together in the NSC, and I can now say a little bit more than I used to. But one is, I always felt, and I was the senior director for Asia while Dan was working these issues, but I always felt, preparing for G8 meetings, that as we worked the agenda, while the U.S. and Britain have a special relationship, it was actually the U.S. and Japan who were most on the same page working these issues. And I have the impression that was true this time as well. And the other thing is, while the G8 does not have a major institutional home, there's no world headquarters for the G8, the fact is it really does drive the agenda. When you look at the APEC summits or the East Asia summits that the United States is not in, and other international gatherings and bilateral negotiations, the G8 really drives and empowers countries like the U.S. and Japan to get follow-up on commitments. And without the G8, other meetings like APEC, the East Asia Summit, would be much less effective. Our bilateral economic negotiations, our discussions of development assistance would be much less effective. So I think it counts. It did a lot, to Dan's credit, to Takumi Sensei and Ambassador Fujisaki's credit. There are some big questions, I think, for the next administration. How do we really get accountability working? I think some steps were made. What do we do about architecture, about the fact that China and India are not in? If you expand the G8 in a formal way to include more countries, what do you do about the fact that the original G5, 6, and 7 summits were of the major economies and the major democracies. How do you get that democracy agenda and the international norms that the democracies represented into the international system and keep it moving? So there's some big questions, but I think the G8 is alive and well and moving forward, and a real testament to the strength of the U.S.-Japan alliance. We've had some problems over North Korea, difficulty passing legislation on security issues, but the G8 is proof that that the U.S.-Japan relationship is very strong indeed, and that we do have common interests and common values, which is a good segue for me to introduce one of the men most responsible for that, Ichiro Fujisaki. Joined the foreign ministry in 1969. He served in all the key posts you would need to be a good ambassador in the U.S. He's worked in the Asia Bureau. He's worked in international organizations. Served most recently in Europe, was the Director General for North American Affairs and Deputy Minister in charge of Economic and Global Affairs, and came last month to Washington after a almost 10-year hiatus when he last served in the embassy to become ambassador. When he was last here, he was one of the key people in what is sometimes called the Nye Initiative, which was a major effort during the Clinton administration to strengthen the U.S.-Japan alliance after the end of the Cold War. And now he's back to check on the accountability and make sure that 10 years later, the U.S. and Japan are continuing that important work. So please join me in welcoming our very distinguished speaker today, Ambassador Ichiro Fujisaki.
Thank you very much, Michelson, for a very kind introduction. This year's G8, as Michael Green said, was a very important summit. I know that every host nation says that this year was special. How can you say this was a usual, ordinary summit if you're a host? But this year, it's really true. I say that because in the last decade, if you look at history, has there been any one year where energy price has doubled, crop price has tripled, and major economies, leading financial market has met credit crisis? No. This was special in that regard. Also, we had less than a year and a half before Denmark's Copenhagen meeting for post-Kyoto framework. So we had to have some guideline to move this UN negotiation. So from that sense as well, this was really critical. And moreover, as suggested by Michael Green, some European leaders, especially French president, were saying that G8 is obsolete already. We have to expand this format. So from that sense as well, we had to really think how we can cope with the situation. And so I can say that this was a watershed G8. We think we collectively done very well in all the important areas. About a month ago, just after I arrived, I gave a briefing on G8 here, utilizing my experience as ex-Sherpa. I was Sherpa for 2003 and 2004, including the Sea Island Summit, carrying the bag of Prime Minister Koizumi at the time. And this time, I went back to Toyako, but mainly I was focusing on bilateral between United States and Japan. So I have been following G8, but I will just limit myself to very important points. First, climate change. For the first time, G8, seeking to share with all the parties in the United Nations, agreed to seek for the long-term goal of 50-50. That is 50% reduction by the year 2050. It is true that base year is not defined, but still, this was the first time that 50% reduction was committed. we are happy to see the United States on board. In the major economic meetings, MEM leaders, although so-called G5, that is China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Mexico, did not come to make clear commitment, G8 position was supported by Indonesia, Republic of Korea, and Australia. We can say that we have made a significant step forward from G8 last year. That was in Germany. In addition, it is to be noted that G8 agreed to formulate ambitious midterm goal for each country, agreed to launch an international initiative for technological innovation, agreed to establish climate investment fund to support developing countries. That was United States who took the first initiative and has made the biggest contribution. UK followed and Japan followed. On world economy and energy, second major topic, G8 committed themselves to continuing sound macroeconomic policy and structural reform. They agreed on the importance of DDA, Doha Development Round, this WTO negotiation. Now, ministers are meeting till midnight or early morning every day in Geneva. I know that very how it is because I was there till 2 months ago. On energy, need for increasing oil production, for developing need for developing conservation technology and need for alternative energies was agreed, and also need for improving transparency in energy market were stressed. That means, of course, energy market is decided by supply and demand, but we have to make it so that there would be no too much element of speculation there. Next, on development and food. Regarding development, G8 focused on health issue. This year, we concluded that on top of addressing individual issues, improving health system of developing countries is indispensable. This was the result of carefully prepared working group led by Professor Takemi, who worked closely with PM Fukuda and Foreign Minister Komura, Finance Minister Nukaga, and Health and Labor Minister Mr. Masuzoe. He'll tell you how we arrived to such conclusion and where we are heading from here. On food security, on top of emergency relief, mid and long-term assistance, including cooperation for agricultural productivity, was emphasized. G8 also called for lifting restriction on food exports and releasing food stocks. It is to be stressed that G8 decided to establish experts group to cope with these issues, all these food security issues. Lastly, political issues. We discussed North Korea, we discussed Iran, we discussed Zimbabwe. North Korea and Iran, non-proliferation and other issues, Zimbabwe on the political situation. For the first time, G8 agreed to issue a political statement that includes how to that it is a necessity to solve the issue of abduction by North Korea. We had such statement starting from 2003 in Chairman's summary. I remember that vividly because I was in that scene. But it was the first time this year that G8 declaration had reference to this statement on North Korea abduction. we are grateful to President Bush in this regard. G8 also reaffirmed their commitment to continue fighting against terrorism and peacekeeping, peace building, and reconstruction efforts on countries which have gone through wars or internal disasters. Lastly, I'm sorry, I said lastly already, but really last. G8 format. G8 has been criticized, as Michael Green said. Some people said it's obsolete. But as I have said in the last briefing I did in CSIS, you should look at this as annual health checkup. We have a democracy and market mechanism. These systems have challenges from termites or whatever every year. In political scene, it could be terrorism. Socially, it could be climate change. Economically, energy price or whatever. You have to mend the fence every year. Try to review the situation and come up with prescription. So that's why sometimes prescriptions look similar, like try not to eat too much or try to run a little bit more every morning. But it's like your health checkup. If you know that what doctor is going to say to you, you don't. Do you say that you're not taking any health checkup? Maybe some of you will say, but that's not good. G8 has been in existence for 30 years, more than. It increased the membership several times. Canada, Italy, Russia, EC. It was in 2000, Okinawa in Japan. We invited, it's in, not in Okinawa, but in Tokyo at the time, but we invited several other leaders for the first time, called Outreach. And in 2003, France expanded and had that kind of outreach as well. Since then, all the countries, including the United States, have always organized some outreach. U.S. case, that was Middle East countries. In Toyako, this time, we invited 14 major economies and African friends in several different meetings. We hope this will set a tone for future G8 summit, which will first have G8 meetings and then invite in others to discuss in larger group a similar issue. And I will emphasize that reportedly French President Mr. Sarkozy also liked the idea to try to discuss G8 first and then expand the meeting. So I think we have, in that sense as well, I think we found maybe good solution to what has been criticized as well. As for a Q&A session that Mr. Morrison has suggested, I have discussed with my colleagues, because I have to skip away to another seminar to give a statement a little different on security issues. And my colleagues said, oh, we can take care of them. You can leave right away. So I think I will trust my colleagues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Professor Takemi. I want to say just a few words about what we've asked him to cover and some of the outcomes. We'll hear more here about the specific outcomes contained. I think this was, by comparison with some previous years on the global health agenda, it was a relatively quiet year, but very important things were happening with respect to strengthening of health systems, with respect to bringing about greater linkages between HIV/AIDS programs and reproductive health and family planning, which was a surprisingly strong language. In terms of renewing the commitments on universal access by 2010 for HIV/AIDS treatment care programs and prevention, and the emphasis upon oversight and accountability that sort of ran through almost every segment of the foreign assistance agenda. This was a period when I think they, leadership that Professor Dakini brought had some innovative impacts in the way that the working group was constituted and its consultations. We'll hear more about that. It was one in which there were lots of competition from other issues to continue to keep the global health agenda forward. And it's one in which the next steps, the handoff to sustaining the type of innovation that he's brought forward, and the handoff in this next year to the next chair, Italy, is another challenge that we'll hear from in his remarks. Professor Takimi headed the Japanese Working Group on the Global Health Agenda. He's a senior fellow at Harvard University School of Public Health. He combines an unusual background of legislative achievement, of foreign diplomacy at a high level, and a passion for global health issues. He had 12 years of service in the upper house. He served as a senior vice minister for health, labor, and welfare, and as the former state secretary in foreign affairs. This is quite a remarkable combination. Thank you so much for coming and being with us here today, Professor Takimi.
Oh, yes, sorry. I'm really delighted at this wonderful occasion to talk about what happened to the G8 concerning with the global health issues. And also I myself, since I lost my job at the upper house election last year, this is the first time for myself have such a large audience in front of the broadcasting. Yeah. So this is another reason, the wonderful occasion for myself. But anyway, I firstly invite your attention on the reason why the Japanese government and our Japanese people pay attention on the global health as one of the key agenda. As you know that we had a very key concept of the human security as a key for our falling and ODA policy making. The why we pay attention on those the very important concept of the human security as a key for ourselves, very closely related to our future-oriented pacifism. As you know, after the World War II ended, so many the Japanese had the personal tragedies. And of course, I know that the many Asian people also suffered from those the Japanese military campaign and lost their own lives. We also lost the 3 million people's lives during the war. So many senior generations of our people has their own personal tragedies during the war, lost their family members and lost their friends. So after the World War II ended, the Japanese has a very strong sentiment against the war and also endorsed by their own personal experiences. But in recent years, the elderly generation is nearly gone. Therefore, those of the original pacifism endorsed by those of the personal experiences become very fragile. But now, we are trying to find out another reason of our future-oriented pacifism. I do realize that the human security is one of the key conceptual framework which can endorse those of the Japanese, the future-oriented pacifism. And when we talk about the human security, the health of human beings is one of the key closely related to the human security concerns. That's the reason why we try to introduce the G8 members' attention on the global health based on our human security approach. In addition to the human security approaches, also this year is the year to review MDG. And in this, the MDG reviews, we have already noticed that the health related the goal of the MDG, the 4 and 5, mothers and child health has not been achieved well than we had expected. And then we noticed that in terms of those other mothers, maternals, and newborn and child health related to the MDG goals, ourselves in Japan, we had a wonderful experiences to improve our own mothers and child health after the World War II ended under the Mothers and Child Health Handbook, which became a symbol of our achievement for health after the World War II ended. And in this approach of the Mothers and Child Health Handbooks, always pay attention on the people and community as a unit of the decision-making, and used the very comprehensive approaches and consistently deliver the services for the mothers, educations, and pregnant health, and newborn child, the safety delivery, and also the new, you know, small children's health check under the name of the Mothers and Child Health Handbook. And this experiences itself, we did notice, is endorsed by the human security approach. The human security, it has so many, you know, arguments in the past. We Japan organized the human security commissions in the past, headed by the Sadako Ogata and Professor Amartya Sen, and produced the report to the Secretary General of the United Nations in 2005. In this report, we focusing on the people and community and used the two conceptual framework of the human empowerment and human protection in order to protect and in order to encourage the people's freedom of from the fears and freedom from the wants. And also we try to protect the humans' well-being and humans' own life and dignity. So those are the factors that gave us real incentives to closely commit on the global health during the preparation process of the G8 summit. Now, I would like to invite your attention on the Okinawa summit in 2000. The then Prime Minister Mori advocated the infectious disease initiatives. At that time, you remember that the HIV/AIDS became a kind of a most serious threat for human beings. Everybody noticed that it's a kind of a very serious pandemic. That's the reason why the infectious disease initiative was endorsed by the very increasing the political momentum. Therefore, became the major agenda for the G8 summit at that time in Okinawa. Now, the Toyako summit that took place, and Toyako summit has been the part of evolving process for the global health policy making since the Okinawa summit. And Toyako summit tried to summarize the plenty of policy proposals for the agenda settings and coordinate concrete subjects and build the consensus among the member states and consistently emphasize the importance of health system strengthening. Japan uses the position of the host nation, utilize so-called participatory approach in order to absorb the newly developed the policy proposals among stakeholders and think tanks and NGOs. Therefore, G8 had health experts meetings three times and invited the leaders of the health aid, such as the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and UNFPA, and even the private sectors of the Gates Foundation, and other stakeholders, such as the government of Norway. So we organized also an official working group, which is the core and symbol of this participatory approach, had a small workshops to exchange ideas and policy proposals, and many times in Bangkok, Zimbabwe in Africa, and also the Geneva, the Washington DC, and New York City, and even in Atlanta. The working group has the lobbying power. The working group consists of the three health-related ministries, as the Ambassador Fujisaki mentioned. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, this is in charge of the G8 summit itself. And also the Ministry of Finance. Ministry of Finance is in charge of the World Bank. World Bank is now the major player for the health issues, as you know. And Ministry of Health, Welfare and Labor. Once I was a senior vice minister for it last year, is in charge of the WHO matter. So this is a little bit complicated for the Japanese decision making. Each ministry has a very strong jurisdiction. So we have to overcome those of the jurisdictions and create new, much more efficient cooperative relationships under this new scheme of the official working group. In addition to those of the official groups, we have also the representatives from the JICA and JBIC, and also the academicians, and also very important members from the NGOs. Therefore, this combination is the real symbol of this participatory approach, because we do realize, as far as we are paying attention on the people and the community level health improvement, we should have the specified cooperative relationships with the NGOs and the civil society in order to deliver the real functionable the services to the people who are really in need. So this participatory approach is not only for the decision-making and agenda setting. This is the core to create the comprehensive health system strengthening. Now, also the working group, as I mentioned, the lobbying power, and connected to those the government officials, including the cabinet members, and sometimes shared the role as a catalyst from the NGOs outside of our countries and those the major policymakers in Japan. However, the G8 documents are the outcome of politics, which always reflect from the political momentum of each agenda. As the Ambassador Fujisaki mentioned, the Toyoko Summit, you do realize that climate change could have the very important increasing political momentum. Therefore, very, very competitive for the agenda setting at that time. Also, the increasing price of the food and increasing price of the energies are both could have the very strong increasing political momentums. So the global health, unfortunately, could not have enough political momentum. This is the one of the major reasons we could not break through the existing financial commitment. That's the one of the reason, I honestly speaking. And then, however, the position of host nation was much more influential than I had expected. The G8 successfully produced the Toyoko Framework for Action. And also the leaders' documents, paragraph 45 and paragraph 46, quite strongly mention about their concern with the global health issues. Then the Toya Lake Summit produced four following up processes, and global health became one of them. The one is the water and sanitation, and education and food, and global health. Now I am talking about the following up process. We decided to follow up the outcome of G8 summit focusing on the global health. In order to promote political momentum to follow up on the Toyako framework for action on global health, so that the commitments at the summit can become much more concrete actions rather than merely the rhetorics. Of the health-related commitments made at the summit, the health system strengthening is one of that is least understood. It is difficult to visualize a strong health system. You can imagine when we talk about the health system to the policymakers. When we talk about the HIV/AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis, it's rather easier for the policymaker to understand how it's important. But when we talk about the health system, hey, Keizo, what does it mean? Very abstract. Could you tell me much more simplified way? But this is a real, you know, the honest story we always have to overcome in everywhere, not only in Japan, I think. Therefore, it's a very, very important for ourselves to carefully explain and invite the policymakers' attention on the health system and create really well-balanced approach for the global health. The focusing on the health system strengthening will help accelerate the MDG reviews and improve disease-specific approaches, as well as strengthening policy primary health care in order to deal with the changing disease, the burden. As you know that in the structure of the medical expenditure in the developing countries, already more than 50% of the medical expenditures is for the chronic diseases, and 10% is for injuries, and the rest, the 40% is for the infectious diseases. So those are the changing structure of the diseases will bring about the new approach, much more efficient, which means that the health system strengthening. They developed the sustainable scheme for integrating the many new policy proposals that are emerging from various stakeholders into the G8 process through a second track process, such as our working group participatory approach. And we try to keep the consistencies, focusing on the global health from Japan to Italy, the next host nation, and try to create the process which can bring about the smooth transition between us. And based on the concept of human security, aimed for integration across sectors among various international actors, working on the global health and across the disciplines, and among individual, the building blocks, focusing on the communities and individuals on the ground as the starting point for the system design. It's a very unique to notice that the role of the community and the people there. The community and people there is the end point of the end point of the implementation process under the top-down decision making. But on the other hand, the community and the people there is the starting point of the bottom-up decision-making. We have to create the really well-balanced combination when we talk about health system strengthening. The human security approach is one of the core to create well-balanced approach for the improving the health, especially in the developing countries. Now, Japan will act as a catalyst to develop the international research and dialogue activities with the aim of producing policy recommendations by January 2009. That can be passed on to the Italy as the host of the next G8 and propose the concrete actions for developing the specific building blocks that were mentioned in the G8, the leaders' documents, such as the health workforce health information, and health financing. The research teams for each of the three building blocks, the health workforce, health information, and the health financing, will develop the policy recommendations based on the literature review and expert interviews and site visit in collaboration with the several stakeholders. The workshop we are having in the beginning of October and conference in the beginning of November, both in Tokyo, to discuss preliminary findings and fine-tune policy recommendations. The task force, which headed by myself and the Professor Michael Rush of Harvard, to write overall paper based on the research team's paper, workshop and conference discussions and discussions with experts from around the world, particularly those working in the developing countries. The present action-oriented policy paper to the Japanese government, which will pass it on to the Italian government to encourage consistency between the summit. And I also strongly appreciate the government of the United States, the very strong initiative to create annual review for the member states' commitment to the global health issues. This is decisively important to create the new, more sustainable scheme among the G8 summits to keep the political momentum and keep the attention on the policymakers for the global health issues. So we would like to utilize this annual review scheme as a more efficient scheme for the future's G8 commitment on the global health issues. Thank you very much.
We're going to pause for a moment. I think the ambassador would like to depart. Do you have any closing comments, Ambassador?
No. As I was saying, that my colleague says that they know a lot better than I do, and they think they can take care of the questions better than I do. So if you would allow, please try to ask tough questions to them. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Our next speaker is Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Sullivan. For the last 2 years, he's served in this role as the Assistant Secretary for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs, which puts him at the center of the preparation and execution of the G8 on a range of issues, and has him at the center of international trade and investment policy, development and debt policy, sanctions, a full spectrum. Prior to that, for several years, he was in the NSC, in the International Economic Directorate, where he was also very active in preparing for the G8, for APEC, and for other related matters. He is a Marine Corps infantry and reconnaissance officer, served for 16 months from early 05 through the spring of 06. In the Iraq theater, working with the commander of the U.S. Central Command. Dan, I know you've been very busy and just returned from being away, and we're very grateful that you found time to be with us today to speak on behalf of the administration. Welcome. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Steve. And it's great to have been able to share the stage with Ambassador Fujisaki. I think what Mike mentioned in this last summit was, and I think in most summits, but was very, very true. The U.S. and Japan worked very, very closely on a number of issues throughout the summit preparation, and the leadership shown by the Prime Minister and all the members of the Japanese government in hosting with great grace and hospitality this summit was something that we were very appreciative of as an administration, but that close working relationship was really key. And so I just wanted to emphasize that at the outset. It's also great to be sharing the stage here with some of my distinguished colleagues. Mike, it's always a pleasure to see you again, Professor. Enjoyed those comments. And I want to mention to Steve and Jennifer, I took part in this setting last year after the G8, and very much enjoyed it. As Steve said, looking to do a full accounting, which we think is very important. But that's why I think this follow-up session is so important, because in many ways, you guys are the health experts. I get a little intimidated when I come here as an econ guy, looking at all the backgrounds of everybody here on these health issues. But that follow-up and full accounting on what the G8 commits to, and I remember saying this last year, hold our feet to the fire on what we did last year. And I think there's no better group that can do that than this group. So I want to applaud CSIS and the Kaiser Foundation for doing this every year. I think it's very, very important, and we want to continue to participate in it. As Steve mentioned, I was the Sioux Sherpa for this past year and the year before. For those of you who are familiar with all the G8 kind of summitry lingo, there's Sherpas, Sioux Sherpas, the assistants to the Sherpas, and Sioux Sherpas are commonly referred to affectionately as yaks. So, they really play out this summit analogy. I actually just spent 2 weeks in Alaska, went from the summit right to Alaska for vacation, and I gave a speech to a group there, and, you know, given the mountaineering culture up there, they just love this notion. So one of my very dear colleagues, Kelly Dillon's in the audience, and although she was referred to as a yak, she really worked hard and did a great job for us. So what I want to do is I want to try and keep my remarks brief. A lot has already been said, and I think it's more important to open up the discussion to some questions. We would agree very much with the ambassador's assessment that this was quite a successful summit from the U.S. perspective. And what I wanted to do was just touch on five key areas where we thought the success was particularly important. The first, again, is the accountability issue. Second is fighting disease in Africa. Third is on confronting climate change. The fourth is on addressing some of the high commodity prices that are significant challenges right now for the global economy. And the fifth is, as Mike talked about, reinforcing our commitments to open markets, strong Doha negotiation, strong Doha completion. And I also wanted to just, again, Mike mentioned it, the ambassador mentioned it, this issue of the G8 relevance. You know, it's everybody's been talking about it. A lot's already been said, but it is a group that works very hard over months to not only set the agenda, but then, as we focused on this year, to follow up on that. And one other thing, though, that is important, you look at these documents. It's also a unique, in a way, group of countries that is very, very serious about committing significant financial commitments to try and address health issues. The Heiligendamm statement last year clearly was focused on that, with significant resources committed, $60 billion, as you're aware. But you again look at the statement this year, $10 billion with regard to the food security issue, $10 billion with regard to clean energy technology, R&D. These are significant resources. And that's another area where it makes the G8 quite a unique grouping of countries that focus on doing that primarily to help developing countries. So I think that's another aspect of the relevance of the G8, not only in terms of the global agenda setting, but also in terms of what the countries are committing to doing. And, again, what you are doing is helping us make sure we meet those commitments, and that's very important. So on accountability, this, as Steve mentioned, and I'm glad that he's seen it, but we thought it was extremely important to have throughout the document, throughout the leader statement, this notion of accountability on past commitments laced throughout the leader statement. It was something we worked closely with the Japanese on. And it was something that built on, we thought it was very important to build on what happened last year at Heiligendamm. Now, I know this group was very familiar with what happened last year with regard to HIV/AIDS and other infectious diseases, malaria. But in essence, what our agenda was last year was to get the rest of the G8 to match what the U.S. has been doing in these areas. And that's why when you look at the targets that were agreed to last year in the G8 on HIV/AIDS and malaria, they are essentially a doubling of PEPFAR and of the President's Malaria Initiative. That's exactly what they were. That's what we intended them to be. And similarly with the financial commitments. So we thought it was very important, having what we thought was a historic outcome last year on disease, to make this year be very focused on accountability. So with the matrices, but it wasn't easy. It was not easy to get these matrices. Hopefully you've taken a look at them. They're not perfect, but we think it is. It is a very important step on getting the accountability issue front and center, cemented in the G8 agenda. And so we think going forward that that's going to be an important outcome of this summit. With that accountability notion, follow-up reports, matrices on health spending is going to be what we hope to be a permanent part of the G8 going forward. I mentioned the matrices. Again, it sounds a little bit wonky sometimes, but this was a very important element of trying to embed accountability. Accountability, as was mentioned, was also a focus in other areas, water, education, corruption, anti-corruption commitments, energy commitments. Again, we were very focused on doing this throughout past commitments, and we hope that and we're confident that that's going to be a continuing focus of the G8 and something that groups such as this would welcome. One thing, just an outcome of this accountability issue, you may have noticed, I'm sure some here were certainly perhaps even involved, but you saw on the day of the summit that the Gates Foundation had committed $150 million to polio eradication. And in their press release, they very, very much focused on this accountability mechanism and focus on accountability by the G8. And the message there that we thought was, if the G8 is accountable for its commitments, you're going to start to see other groups, other government, non-government organizations that will come together and also be accountable. And so we thought that was an important signal, an important way to build public-private partnerships that are really going to be the key to addressing many of these health issues. One thing we haven't really talked about, I'll just briefly touch on here, but we also thought it was important to expand some of the G8's commitments on addressing health issues. So there, hopefully you've seen, and again, to try and get targets related to such goals. So there's language on increasing and committing to training health workers that is in the statement. There's also a whole new focus on neglected tropical diseases, which had come up in other summits, but again, without a focus of a target in countries and specific numbers. And that's in there now. We can talk about that. And even something as specific as bed nets with regard to malaria. Very, very ambitious target in there of 100 million long-lasting bed nets by the end of 2010. Next point I wanted to talk about, again, it was already been stated with regard to what occurred with regard to climate change and the focus both on a long-term greenhouse gas reduction target, but importantly, as part of that, at least 50% by 2050, a very strong focus in the G8 that has to be in conjunction with commitments made by other major economies. And so this is why we thought one element that was successful of the summit was both having the G8 summit and then the major economies meeting that took place essentially in conjunction with the G8 summit. And as Mike mentioned, this was an initiative that the President Bush launched last year prior to the Heiligendamm summit. But the key element there was any major progress is going to be made with regard to global climate change. The global climate change challenge has to be with regard to all the major economies. And this was an important start. My colleague Dan Price, the Sherpa, led this process over the last year, and we thought that the leaders' meeting with regard to the major economies focused on climate was a very, very important process of plugging into the UNFCCC process for a post-2012 framework. Also, we haven't talked about it, but one thing that I did want to highlight with regard to climate is every year the G8 had focused on the importance of clean energy technology as a key to addressing climate change. They always focused on it and talked about its importance. What we thought this year that was important was to show action on that. And we thought action in three different areas: basic R&D by G8 countries that governments fund, commercialization incentives, so to help bring new technologies to market and decrease the risk of doing so, and then deploying these technologies. And if you look at the G8 leader statement this year, you really have a lot of significant action-oriented statements by the G8 in all three of these areas. A $10 billion commitment to basic R&D, which is very important. U.S. is already doing about $4 billion annually under President Bush. A commercialization focus. It, unfortunately, from our perspective, didn't have a target on it. We wanted one. We were unable to get it. Our Department of Energy has a $42.5 billion loan guarantee program for commercialization of greenhouse gas reducing technologies, which we think is a good example of that kind of commercialization. And with regard to deployment, a strong focus on reducing tariffs on clean energy technology goods and services. We have a joint proposal with the EU at the WTO negotiations that we think is an important way to do that. And as was already mentioned, the Clean Energy Technology Fund, which has been jointly a focus of efforts by the U.S., Japan, and the U.K., and in the leader statement, there's a $6 billion commitment on that by the G8, which we think was an important outcome. Just a few more quick issues. One that I want to highlight because I think it was particularly important and, again, a great example of Japan's leadership at the summit, but on the food security issue. There is a separate statement. There was only two real separate statements in the summit documents, one on food security, one on counterterrorism. And if you haven't already done so, I would encourage you to take a look at that food security statement. We think that it is very action-oriented. It embeds the idea of accountability. It embeds the idea of the G8 working with other important organizations, global organizations, of course, other countries. And it makes a lot of commitments. And we think that, and I can tell you from being one of the negotiators, we work quite hard on that statement. And we think that there's a lot there, and it's going to be an important statement. And hopefully there'll be strong follow-up on that that will help with regard to addressing what is a significant global problem with the dramatic rise of food prices, particularly for some of the poorest countries in the world. And I can talk about some of the specific aspects of that if you'd like. And similarly, as the ambassador noted, there was a strong focus on addressing high energy prices, although, as we all know, there's no quick fix to that, but basic focus on supply and demand elements of that, maintaining commitments to previous commitments by the G8, particularly at St. Petersburg, was also important. And then finally, the fifth area, as I mentioned, as Mike noted, one area where the G8 consistently, I think, plays a global leadership role and sets the agenda for the rest of the world is on the commitment to open investment, strong trade liberalization focus, and despite obvious headwinds and challenges that we're now facing, as opposed to last year, with regard to the global economy, there was still a very strong element of the commitment to maintaining open markets, to a strong Doha, which we think will give, which is giving, as the ambassador noted, impetus to the ministerial negotiations going on literally as we speak in Geneva on Doha, and expanding cooperation in important areas to the G8 economies, such as intellectual property rights. So that's an overview. Again, we thought it was a strong summit. And Mike had mentioned at the outset even this idea of the international architecture, there's a paragraph in there recognizing that this is important, that there's ongoing work, that the G8 and other countries need to continue to look at ways to make the international economic institutions as effective as possible. So thanks for your time, and again, I really want to applaud this group and the hosts here for what I think is an outstanding event to follow up on what the G8 does every year. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Dan. I mean, I hope in the discussion we can come back to some of these issues. It was very significant, obviously, that there was a shift in the context of this summit of the G8 towards an agreement on the climate change framework, and it would be useful to hear. I mean, the Washington moved a distance, and others moved a distance in moving towards that. And I think you deserve a lot of the members deserve a lot of commendation for what happened on the food. On the food global food crisis issue. I mean, you did not shy away from targeting FAO as a particularly chronic problem. You put a heavy effort on trying to boost Doha, ease the trade restrictions, and you avoided getting into a food fight over biofuels, which maybe you can tell us a little more about that when we get into the discussion. Our concluding speaker, who's been very patient, is Jennifer Cates, Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation. She's a close friend, longstanding ally and partner of the CSIS work on HIV/AIDS and related issues in global public health. This is a remarkable organization which brings really exceptional capacities for objective and very informed analyses, packaging of data, and new and very innovative partnerships with global media, among others. This product that Jennifer has driven forward over the last several years of tracking donor commitments and trying to disaggregate them and compare them and grasp what is a very complex set of issues and streams has proven to be very, very valuable. Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here. And yes, I've been patient, but you've been patient, and now you have to bear with me as I show you some data, but I will make it quite quick. We're very pleased, Kaiser Family Foundation is very pleased to once again be co-hosting this event, which we've done now with CSIS for several years after the G8 summit, as you've heard from the others, really to bring people together and reflect upon what happened at the summit, largely focused on health but other related areas, and looking forward to the next summit. So it's provided a good bridge. And I really want to thank Steve Morrison for his leadership in this area and helping make this happen. And I also have to just call out Kate Hoffler at CSIS, who probably is what we consider the Sherpa for much of the CSIS efforts that we've been working on together. So thank you, Kate. Also, a special thanks to Ambassador Fujisaki and Professor Takimi for making themselves available for this event. We really wanted to have them here, and we're just very, very glad that it all worked out. And thanks to Dan coming again, and hopefully he'll come again in the future when we ask him, and to Mike for comments. So what I'm going to do is very quickly provide you with some background data. It's always good to have, you know, some data to anchor some of these discussions. This is a report that we do every year. We did it this year with consultants at the Henry L. Stimson Center, Eric Leaf and Jonathan Pearson. And the report itself will not be released by the foundation until Monday, but we made copies available to you and can make them available, you know, before Monday if you want them electronically. The research that we do here is using the OECD data that donors use to provide their commitments. So we actually are just mining that data set to take out of that data, very, very rich data set, what donors are providing and committing on health. There are a couple things I should say about these data. As you can see, we have some great trends, 2001 to 2006, so we have a wide picture to look at, and we can look at changes over time. But 2006, we're in 2008. So this is the latest year for which the data at this level of detail will be available. So that's a lag, and it's not going to tell us the current snapshot, and that's a limitation. It's not going to reflect more recent commitments and bigger, maybe some new changes. But I will say that for those of us working in the field, there's probably not that much of a shift between 2006 and 2008 that would remarkably change the story here. But we'll keep monitoring it, so we'll be able to see that. The data, as I mentioned, are from donors to the OECD. They represent official development assistance, which is what donors provide to low- and middle-income countries. It does not include assistance that's provided to countries in transition, so that's no longer collected by the OECD. So we have a limitation there as well. So very quickly, the first figure, and this should be available to all of you, looks at ODA, all of official development assistance for everything, health, education, everything together over this period. And a couple points to make here. You see a dramatic increase from 2001 to 2006. But in the last year, you see a decrease. This is nominal amounts in U.S. dollars. What that means, it's not adjusted for inflation. It's not adjusted for any kind of currency revaluation. So we actually see a nominal decrease in the last year. Despite the increase over the period, it's important to note that a large part of this increase is driven by inflation, is driven by aid to Iraq, Afghanistan, is driven by debt relief. And when you take that out, which we're not showing here but it's in the paper, the increase is much less. For health, on the other hand, you also see a big increase over this entire period and a steady increase. And even after adjusting for inflation and other factors, there's still an increase in health ODA. So that's a good thing. This looks at the comparison between 2001 and 2006, just by all of the major sectors, debt relief, emergency assistance, et cetera, and health. And actually, the darker blue there. What you see here is that health is actually increasing as a share of ODA, which reflects what a lot of us know. One other thing I want to say about health, and you can see it highlighted there, we broadly define health here. The way we define health for this analysis is health, which is one sector of the data that OECD collects from donors, and population, which is another related sector of data, which actually includes HIV, STDs. And health and population together are what OECD calls health. But we also include water, and by water we mean the types of water-funded activities that really contribute to health overall. We think that's really important. The paper disaggregates all of this, but that's what that represents here. So you see an increase from 13% of ODA in 2001 to 17% in 2006. I'll just briefly talk about this. We also wanted to see the contributions for ODA, particularly in 2006, that were made by contributions to Iraq, Afghanistan, and debt relief and emergency assistance, just so you can get a sense of how much of official development assistance is actually going to those activities, which are distinct from health, from education, et cetera. Also on debt relief, just so people understand, that's debt relief is not the same as a dollar whatever currency. It costs donors significantly less to provide debt relief. So that's just important to note for trends. This looks at by donor, defined very broadly. We don't have disaggregated by each donor here, but we can provide that. And what you see, and you don't see big changes in the donor shares from 2001 to 2006, but what you do see is that the U.S. is the largest single donor at about a quarter of ODA in 2006, and that includes PEPFAR commitments in 2006, but many other things as well. And the European nations together as a group are about a third, and if you add the EC, that's another 6%. So this just gives you a sense of where are commitments by donors coming from and where are they going. I think this is a good sign here that most of the commitments are being channeled towards sub-Saharan Africa, South and Central Asia, where we know the biggest health challenges really lie. So this reflects what we know and seems to be where donors are largely channeling funds. This is a complicated graph here, and I just will highlight some main things. We looked at, for 2006, underneath those big numbers, what's going on in the health and water sectors, what's being funded, what's getting the biggest shares. And what you see, broadly speaking, is that disease-specific initiatives really drive most of donor support. And this came up earlier. It's much easier for donors to grasp a disease-specific funding initiative. Those tend to drive up funding. Those tend to be what donors gravitate towards. But some of the basic building blocks, like health training that's at the bottom, and even basic health infrastructure that's sort of midway there at about $700 million, these are the basic building blocks of health, the infrastructure, the systems that we're all talking about and know need to be strengthened that really aren't getting as much support. And that's, I think it's an ongoing challenge. The G8 addressing that more directly this year is a very good sign. I know that the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City, which begins in about a week and a half, that's a big theme, health system strengthening. But again, how you then galvanize the response in that area is a big challenge. This looks at changes over time as well. This takes 2001 to 2006 by those subsectors. And here what's important to note, again, is the disease-specific initiatives are driving much of the growth in health. And some of these basic building blocks are not. And in fact, health training and family planning saw decreases over the period. So we're not really seeing some of the building blocks in some of the sectors experience as much growth as others. And you see some similar patterns in water as well. Just told you I'd keep it short. I just want to make a few concluding comments about this. I think for implications here, there's clearly uneven funding by subsector, and how that gets addressed is very important to watch. For example, if donors end up shifting within the pie, that's not necessarily going to address all of the challenges. Shifting from an infectious disease initiative to a basic building block takes from the infectious disease initiative. So I think the questions about how big that pie should be is the open question here. The other is that the funding in general, official development assistance overall, the increase that we saw was driven in large part by expected debt relief repayments and forgiveness, and that's not going to continue. What does that mean? Well, that means that donors may have additional funds that they could use for other areas, but because, as I mentioned earlier, debt relief isn't the same value, costs a lot less to donors. It means donors have less freed up assistance that they could put in other areas. So we're not really sure how that's going to play out. Other initiatives could be introduced. We know that, as Steve mentioned, PEPFAR reauthorization passed Congress last night. That's $48 billion over 5 years that will be at least committed to HIV, malaria, and TB. So that will significantly, we think, increase commitments. Will there be other disease-specific initiatives? Unclear. Will there be innovative financing mechanisms? Unclear. Although the PEPFAR reauthorization does include something around advanced market commitments. So there are lots of developments to watch, but overall the picture, I would say, is mixed. And I'd be happy to answer specific questions about the report. And again, it should all be available to you and posted on our website by Monday. And also the webcast of today's event will be posted on our website and CSIS's website by the end of today, I believe. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. We have some time remaining. Thank you for being so patient. Those are excellent presentations. What we're going to do is take a couple of rounds of questions and comments. We have microphones, and if you could just simply raise your hand, we'll take three or four at a time. Try to be very succinct and limit your comment and question to a single intervention, and please identify yourself. Yes, sir. Please use the microphone.
I'm with the Global Union AIDS Program, and I would like to bring greetings to Professor Takemi from the Global Health Committee of the Japanese NGO Forum, which, along with the World AIDS Campaign, was a partner of ours in pressing for several years for the follow-up mechanism which you created. And I'd like to commend the United States for its leadership in this regard, too. But my question really relates to the legacy phase of the G8 process. and if it would be possible for both the representative from the United States and also Professor Takimi, to the extent that you can inform us, what the plans are between now and the handover of the presidency in this legacy phase process to help shape what this mechanism really is and what it is to do. We understand that there are meetings that are being talked about for September or October. We take to heart the comments that began in Heiligendamm, which is basically stressing the need for this strategy, this document, this the outcome of this process to inform strategy. And we also note that there is a strong desire to have stakeholder input included in the process. So these are two elements that civil society is ready and willing to stand by to help inform over the course of the next few months, and we'd like to get some advice and direction in terms of how we proceed.
Thank you. Let's take a few additional comments and questions right here. And then there's one in the back.
Thank you. I'm Georgia Sambinaris with USAID. And I would like to thank you again for an excellent program. My question really relates to Professor Takimi's initiative, but perhaps others like Ms. Cates and Mr. Morrison would like to comment. To what extent do you think that preparations for the next G8 summit, moving forward on social health insurance and financial systems for health, will include private provider insurance and third-party payment mechanisms? And the reason I ask this is because in the PEPFAR funding, the private sector finance aspect, which is provides for more rapid delivery and decentralization efforts, it accelerates those, is being excluded to a certain extent from the Ministry of Health initiatives. And I think the governance aspect and the third-party payment mechanisms are very important. And I would also mention just quickly that Italy's central bank has a lead in some of these finance guarantee mechanisms that may offer some solutions.
Thank you. We have one hand up back here.
Hi, I'm Krista Jacobs with the International Center for Research on Women. Thank you for having this forum today. My question is, I'm hoping you can give highlights or talk about any consensus that there was about the midterm and long-term support for agriculture and food security.
Thank you. My name is Reese Scott. I'm a student at Georgetown University, and my question is for Assistant Secretary Sullivan and partially also for Takemi Sensei. my question relates to the global commodity prices that you mentioned earlier. It seems to me that Japan has one method that's readily available to it to ease the commodity prices, and that is to release some of its rice reserves. So, but it seems that Japan is sort of dragging its feet on this issue, and to add insult to injury, they are now releasing some of the reserves to feed cattle. So, my question for Secretary Sullivan is, why are you optimistic about positive outcomes resulting from G8 food security statements? And if Takemi Sensei could also briefly comment, I would appreciate that as well. Thank you.
Okay. All right, we have four questions on the table. Professor Takimi, would you like to lead off with responding to some of these?
Thank you very much. Very interesting questions. Firstly, I'd like to talk about what can be a sustainable scheme for the annual review. And this is a very, you know, important the subject, you know, in order to follow up itself. But still there are so many uncertainties, quite honestly speaking, that in terms of our schedule for the following up after the G8 summit to the next summit for the Italians, we are setting up continuously our working group as an official, you know, entity in collaboration with very closely with the government side, and set up the specified task forces the focusing on the health system strengthening, such as health workforce, and also health information, and also health financing. And then we are organizing a very small the preparatory the meeting at the beginning of October, and also the larger size of the convention will be taking place in Tokyo the beginning of November. And I do hope that the government side will also organize the health expert meeting, which had had the three times before the G8 summit, will be held again for the following up process at the same time we are organizing the convention at the beginning of November, I hope. And because it can be a much more efficient to collaborate each other. But this is still the several uncertainties, no any real consensus yet. I really hope that the U.S. government can join it. Anyway, this is the Japanese approach for the sustainable scheme. But the what sort of sustainable scheme can be formulated will be very, very heavily depend upon the next host nation, the Italian government. So we should, collaborate with the Italian partners for our own following up process. So this can be a real challenge for the G8 member state as well. And the secondly, the health, the financing related to the health insurance system, right? The as a result of the UK's the Gleneagles summit, the providing for health initiatives came out, and specifically focusing on health financing, including health insurance system building, in order to create real universal access to the people who really in need in the developing countries. We have succeeded those initiatives. That's the reason why in our document specifically welcome the health, providing for health and international health partnership and the catalytic initiative as well. However, the health financing means so many other subjects as well. So in this following up process, we are carefully select the concrete subject and the name of the health financing task forces. So how we can choose those of the concrete subject is totally depend upon those the following up process as well. But I hope that the health insurance is one of the key for the health financing issues. And the food security is really related to the health issues very much indeed. As you know pretty much about the Japanese government has so much the rice reserved, including the imported rice. We decided to utilize those the reserved rice for the food security, not only for our nation, but also for the people who are really in need in the developing countries as well. But this is the urgent approach. So maybe Mr. Sullivan is talking about the much longer term of the food security approach, but this is decisively important is to collaborate each other for those the major countries to create the real sustainable scheme for the food security issues in the middle term and the longer term. Thank you.
Yeah. Let me just, I'll just make a few additional comments. On the legacy question, I think Professor Takimi already spoke to that very eloquently. I can just tell you, though, one thing from the negotiation perspective when we get together, and, there's several sessions that we work with in conjunction with the Sherpas to negotiate the leader's statement, but countries take this extremely seriously, and I can't overemphasize that enough. So the fact that you have, you know, in the paragraphs on health, a sentence that talks about not only the Toyako framework for action, but the statement, we also agree to establish a follow-up mechanism to monitor our progress on meeting our commitments. That's not language that is lightly viewed by any country, particularly the country that's going to be the next G8 president. So I can assure you that those words are taken seriously by all the G8 countries. We were particularly pleased with that language and were supportive and pushing for it. But I guarantee you the Italians, I mean, I don't want to speak for the government of Italy, but anywhere there was a follow-up of what will happen next year under the Italian presidency, there was a particular interest by my colleagues from that government, and I think a very sincere one. So I think, and again, the statement tries to be detailed enough without being too detailed. And again, I think the Japanese did a great job of striking that balance. So, of course, not every detail is laid out, but there's some very strong language in here on the importance of accountability follow-up that I think will be hopefully cement that concept for many G8s to come. With regard to food security issues, on the question on the media or the medium and longer term, again, I would just and maybe you've already done it, but take a look at the statement. There was an intense amount of effort that went into this statement to try and make it action-oriented. There's a paragraph 7 there that lays out particularly for a G8 leader statement, very specific actions with targets, both medium term, longer term, in the paragraphs preceding that shorter term, and it's quite comprehensive. These statements never come out in the most beautifully crafted way, but we think that there's quite a lot in there. And already you see in there what's interesting is a built-in follow-up mechanism with the establishment of a new G8 leaders, a G8 group that will focus on these issues. That's important. And again, it's something that we thought was particularly important. And then there's even, and this is something that, again, just because I spent so much time on this, there is a discussion or statement in the leader statement about calling for countries with sufficient food stocks to make available part of their surplus for countries in need. And that's in there. And also an idea that the G8 says they're going to explore about a virtual internationally coordinated reserve system that Bob Zelik at the World Bank has spoken about. So we think there's quite a lot in there, but we hope that groups like this will make sure that we're making good on our commitments. Finally, as you know, the issue of what's causing the significant increase in global commodity prices, particularly food prices, is quite complicated. And the best way to view it is that there are many, many factors that are kind of coming together, supply side, demand side, oil, energy side, some of the tensions with regard on biofuels. I mean, there's a number of different factors. And what the G8 was really focused on was not trying to parse that, although there's clearly a call for looking at what's underlying the significant increase, but how to address it. And one of the things that, again, in this statement that we think is a very important outcome of the leader statement is this focus on productivity increases and production increases in Africa and focusing on investing in technologies and productivity increases, which will take the medium and longer term. But that's all laid out in this statement, and again, it's why we thought, again, with strong Japanese leadership, that this was a really important outcome, and we hope that the follow-through will be just as robust.
Let's take another round of comments and questions. While you're weighing that, I'm going to put a couple of things on the table. On Zimbabwe, it's very interesting that such a strong statement came forward with Russia on board. It created quite a bit of momentum running into the Security Council subsequently. Now, things got problematic at the Security Council, and that's not what we're here to talk about. But implicitly in the statement was an omission of any reference or support to Mbeki's mediation effort, which was quite startling, and an appeal for a broader mediation effort, and a call for targeted sanctions that the Russians embraced. Perhaps you can comment, Dan, a little bit about how did that happen? How did you get that consensus? Was it a matter of dropping the call for an arms embargo? Was it simply that this wasn't tied to UN Security Council actions, which later became quite complicated with the ICC indictment of Bashir and others, and it was possible to get the Russians to take such a pretty dramatic stand? I'm going to put that out as one issue. On the investment in rural agriculture, I think the language, the productivity targets were very refreshing. The fact that the statements that were made were so directly and pointedly reinforcing what Zelic had put forward, what Josette Sheeran had put forward, what the Ban Ki-moon had come forward. It just reinforced this dramatic set of initiatives that had unfolded in the previous 90 days, and I think it was very, very constructive. Hopefully next year we'll get to the point where the investment in rural agriculture takes greater shape in terms of targets over the long term. I realize it was premature. This picture was moving too quickly. But the fact that there was a commitment made on a 6% productivity gain and there was a full embrace of the Africa program, that was terrific. That was a terrific addition and very, very timely. Are there other issues right here? And then Ed.
Thank you to all the panelists for a very informative link to what we weren't able to attend. I'd like to ask for comments specifically on the question of health education, health literacy as a key component of progress in the whole domain of health, water, well-being, nutrition. We know that maternal education literacy is a key determinant of child health. So Takemi-sensei was commenting on maternal child health. How do we get that sort of wedge issue onto following agendas? I saw how water and sanitation were worked on very deliberately this year in the past, HIV/AIDS. How can the civil society organizations make that happen? Thank you.
Thank you. Ed Scott, Heather.
Hi, I'm Ed Scott from the Center for Global Development, but I don't want to ask a development question. I want to ask a security question for Professor Green or Assistant Secretary Sullivan. Mugabe's a, you know, real big problem for Africa and for the world, but he's nothing like the threat to peace that the Arab-Israeli, the Palestinian-Israeli situation is. So I wonder, I didn't see anything come out of the G8 on that, and maybe I missed it, but why would the G8 not focus on that as probably one of the most central threats to global security that's been festering forever?
Let's take one more if there's a hand up over here. Please identify yourself.
My name is Charlie Grant. I'm just a student intern. I'm with the CDC, but you know, my question actually has to do with energy security, and I was wondering if there was any talk of just different energy negotiations at the G8. I know this is sort of a summit about health, but I'm kind of personal interest in particular, like say offshore drilling or different, you know, sort of things like that. I don't know if there was any international talks going on there, but.
Okay, well, there was a segment on energy and global energy, and we can get some comment on that. Dan, do you want to lead off on this?
Sure.
On this set of issues, and then we'll go to Professor Takemi and Mike and Jeff.
Try and be brief on some of these. Steve, on your question on Zimbabwe, I think we thought it was a strong statement as well, and I'm pleased that the G8 leaders agreed to such a what we thought was a strong statement, all the G8 leaders. Without getting into kind of the details, I think that, you know, one of the other good things about we've been talking about the G8, its relevance, and one element that you see when you're at the summit is that these discussions are very, they cover a lot of ground among the leaders. They're very free-flowing. They're not scripted. And so there's a really healthy, good exchange that takes place during the summit among the leaders. And I can say that in part because the topic of Zimbabwe was on the minds of many leaders, and it came up in many different fora in a way, and many of the leaders of the G8 felt very strongly about it, that I think that sense in the discussions really lended itself to having a strong statement. And so it was really in many ways an outcome of the strong feelings that many of the G8 leaders had on this topic, and it did come up a lot. I think on health, education, literacy, I'll leave that to the experts. I'm, again, clearly not one of them. The one area, though, that we thought is important to highlight, and it came up a lot as we were very interested in, from the U.S. perspective, putting forward an initiative within the G8 on neglected tropical diseases. You may have seen the President's initiative on this for $350 million commitment with specific targets. But it was very interesting to me as we had these discussions how NTDs affect many other things, particularly education in developing countries and the economic outlook of countries. So that kind of integrated look I found very interesting because it does relate to education and economics and health, and these things are all interrelated. On the Middle East piece, you know, there's a whole session where the leaders talk about global security issues, and of course that was a topic. And the way that comes out, the way it came out in the summit, and unfortunately I don't have a copy with me, the Japanese, as the presidency, they prepare a chair's summary on what was discussed with regard to those topics. And, of course, the Middle East peace issues are laid out in that chair summary that kind of tries to summarize where the focus of the leader's discussion was. And that's online. I'm sure we can get it for you if you need to see. And then on energy security, the issue was discussed at length. It's a very, very significant concern of every G8 leader that was there. And I won't bore you with all the details of what's in the statement, but there's some what we thought was pretty strong language. And, again, this issue of accountability. What we thought was very strong language on energy security issues 2 years ago, the St. Petersburg Summit has energy security principles, which we think, if countries abide by, it will help with regard to alleviating some of the supply and demand issues that are causing significant hikes in oil prices. And there was reports on how countries are doing with regard to implementing these, the G8 countries had the International Energy Agency help prepare these reports. These were published. So, again, it goes into the broader accountability theme of the summit that we thought were important. But there's a lot in the statement on different elements of energy security, and as you can imagine, it was a topic that was discussed at length.
Just briefly on the security question and energy, one of the problems with the G8 summit statements until people like Dan came along is that they were getting too long. And when you put out a leader statement that's a laundry list, you sacrifice something. You lose focus on some key issues. And the trend for the U.S. government, I think for Japan and some others, has been to try to really focus on those areas where a statement in the summit statement would really help to move the agenda forward. And clearly this time it was Iran, Zimbabwe, and North Korea, largely because it was in Japan. And I thought, as a North Korea watcher, it was very useful that the leaders called on North Korea to implement its commitments under two Security Council resolutions. And I thought, just in the tea leaf reading world of North Korea, that was a very helpful reminder to North Korea that noncompliance could lead to further pressure or sanctions, which is included explicitly in both those resolutions. So useful to highlight that, help to push forward the diplomacy as we're trying to get North Korea to agree to some verification procedures, useful with Iran before the EU meetings. And useful, I think Steve would know better, in, at least until it hits some headwinds in the UN Security Council with respect to Zimbabwe. The other thing is these summits have ministers' meetings in the lead-up. So there are energy ministers' meetings, foreign minister meetings. So a lot of these issues get attention there and follow-up. And I think Middle East in particular for Secretary Rice and energy for Secretary Bodman obviously would have been key themes. And finally, I thought going into this that energy would get somewhat less attention because the Saudis' very clever preemptive strike with the Jeddah meeting took a little bit of the steam out of this, or the gas out of this, or the oil out of this, because I think if the Saudis hadn't done that, I think the EU would have come up with a much stronger statement that the producing countries, even with Russia in the mix, the producing countries might not have liked. I think that's one of the reasons the Saudis jumped ahead and started to try to fix this. So that may have been a factor why you saw a little less than you might have expected.
Thank you. Professor Takimi, there are some health issues that were
yes.
put on the table.
The education is, as you said, that very closely related to the health issues, very much indeed. And in the documents of the leaders, the documents at the G8 summit, precisely mentioned that the health issues is not only can be resolved through the health sectors, the close sectoral approaches are always required for improving the health conditions for every people. So now that we try to pay attention on those the comprehensive approach, not only at the nation, you know, national level, but also the community levels, and intentionally create those the synergy effects among the educations and also the health services, and also the waters and sanitation services in the community levels. This is a decisively important the approach for us to follow up under the name of human security. And also, I just want to mention it's one very interesting experience of myself as a head of the unofficial group for the agenda setting at the G8 summit. I myself is a professor of international relations at the university in our own country. But the first experience to commit on this sort of the job for the G8 decision making, partly focusing on the global health. But I do realize that under the very speedy the globalization in this very crowded planet, those are the common agenda beyond the national boundaries are increasing quite rapidly in these global communities. And then the very interesting, the unique new kind of power gains are coming out. In the past, mostly we pay attention on those the power gain based on the geographical conditions. But now, that within 20 and 30 years, we can say that the country which can have the increasing capacity to resolve this sort of common agendas in the global community can gain much more influential positions in the global politics. So this is the unique, the new the dimensions for the international politics is coming out. Now, I do hope that the U.S.-Japan alliance can be utilized for this purpose as well. So this sort of soft powers, which are shared by both countries, can contribute for the resolution of those the new coming the common agendas in the global community, and contribute for the human survival order in this the century. This can be another job for the new dimension of the U.S.-Japan alliance, I think. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Jen, can you, I mean, you, just one last question, and then I think we're going to close. The data that you present says a couple of powerful things. One, there's been a major shift that looks like a towards very high commitments, and a very surprising shift in terms of the scope and scale of commitments that have been made in the last 5 years. Second point is it may be at a plateau, perhaps. I mean, the reauthorization that just went through Congress would suggest that we're not at a plateau. We're going to continue to see a climb. But the most recent data of the last 2 years suggests that. And the third point is that this enduring problem of such a dichotomy or between the disease-driven commitments versus those that are going into the basic training and infrastructure. Can you just offer a little reflection on that? Because the data that you've pulled together is very unusual, and it tells a story. The question is, what is that story?
Well, actually, looking at these trends, it doesn't seem like there's a plateau. I mean, it does seem like there's an increase both when we did adjust, we didn't include it in the paper, adjusting for inflation and taking other factors into consideration, health commitments in general are going up. I think that a large driver of that is PEPFAR, the U.S. being the largest single contributor. It's certainly not if you group Europe together, you're getting a third. But it's a big driver, and with the recent reauthorization, we expect that to continue. I think the question is, what else is going to drive that increase, if at all? But the bigger issue is the last one you brought up, which is within the funding. There's one question about whether the pie is enough. The pie is big enough to really meet all the needs. And we mentioned this in our paper, that based on the last the estimates that were put out by the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health, they're not. I mean, the pie is not big enough to meet the need. So that's just an open question still. How big should it be? Who's going to expand it, et cetera? Then the other big question is, regardless of that, within the pie, how does it get distributed? How do you address these basic issues, health training of personnel, education of the population, basic infrastructure, laboratory facilities, et cetera, while not taking away from the disease-specific initiatives. And also, I mean, you know, to some extent, looking at these data is an artifact of how things get coded. We know that, in reality, a disease-specific initiative does include infrastructure enhancements, does include education. And so part of this is how donors are categorizing their funding commitments. But that, I don't think that explains most of it, but that we have to understand that these are categories that are being used. So that's one thing going on. But I think the two big issues are, how big should the pie be, and will it continue to grow in real terms? And the second, especially with the economy, this is 2006. This is before the last 2 years of all of the economic woes that have plagued most all nations. So that's a big factor. But the other is within that pie. How does it get distributed? And to the extent that it's a zero-sum picture, it's not a good situation to redistribute necessarily. So,
yeah, I just wanted to follow up on those comments and just, A, make one plug, and some of you are probably familiar with this, but it doesn't come out in the press much, but you see this administration has undertaken the largest increase in development assistance in any kind of 5 or 6 year period since the Marshall Plan. I mean, it is dramatic. And the last year of ODA in the Clinton administration was about $10 billion. You see Jen's numbers there. We're averaging about 22, 23 in that period. It's very, very dramatic. Of course, it's bipartisan, but I think this is something where the president, you don't always read about that in the same article, and it's a significant achievement, I think, of the entire Bush administration. But secondly, a more interesting question is not only the two that Jen laid out, but actually what is the pie? And one of the things that we've been doing, and this is really more in kind of its health, but it's kind of more directly in the realm that I deal in, is looking at total flows, not just ODA, but other things. And I know there's a lot of studies on this, but whether it's foreign direct investment or net imports or remittances, or now you're starting to see charity, right? I mean, charity or NGOs, but significant money from foundations or debt relief. I mean, when you look at those numbers, when you go abroad and you talk to countries, in a lot of ways, countries are a lot, developing countries are a lot more interested in getting that foreign direct investment or an export platform built up than they are in terms of getting increased ODA. And so it's an issue that I think is getting more and more attention, but the pie of just looking at the ODA pie doesn't really tell the full story, and it misses a lot, and misses actually a lot of what I think a lot of developing countries really want in terms of total flows. And so I just want to throw that out there because I think it's something that's getting a lot more attention.
Great. Thank you very much. We've gotten to the end of our time this morning. I want to especially thank Heather Texera, Suzanne Brundage, Kate Hoffler for putting this event together. I want to thank all of our speakers for coming and spending such an extended period of time on this complex array of issues. I want to thank Kaiser Family Foundation for webcasting this and providing us again with that service. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.